Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. All is quiet outside the White House at this hour following an apparent security breach. U.S. media outlets reporting the Secret Service said that a person was arrested without incident late Friday night after scaling a section of fence around the White House. Authorities say the intruder was carrying a backpack that did not contain anything hazardous. So far, the name of the person has not been released. President Trump was reportedly in the White House at the time of the incident. Twin bombings in Syria's capital Saturday are said to have killed at least 40 people and wounded dozens more, making it one of the most deadly attacks in the Syrian capital during the six-year civil war. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the blast hit an area of Damascus near Shiite mausoleums that draw pilgrims from around the world. Pilgrims had gathered at a bus station to visit a nearby cemetery. Iraq's foreign ministry said most of the dead and wounded are Iraqis, or were Iraqis, rather. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. The U.S. plans to send 1,000 soldiers to Kuwait as part of its effort to counter the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. The plan comes as officials tell VOA a contingent of Marines have arrived in Syria to provide additional capabilities for allied forces working to push Islamic State forces from their de facto capital of Raqqa, Syria. Japan is commemorating Saturday the wake, the earthquake that is, and tsunami disaster at the Fukushima nuclear plant 6 years ago that killed thousands. At the exact time of the quake hitting northeastern Japan on March 11th, people around the nation bowed their heads in a moment of silence. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Junita Party won a landslide victory in the politically crucial northern state of Uttar Pradesh, giving the Indian leader a huge boost halfway through his term. Sanjay Kumar is a political analyst in New Delhi.
All a win-win situation for Mr. Modi and for BJP. This indicates an approval of Modi's policies. This also gives an indication that Modi's popularity is clearly intact. He has been able to establish a good connect with the people.
Modi personally led his party's campaign in Uttar Pradesh, promising growth and defending his controversial ban on high-value currency notes, which many feared would alienate poor voters in an impoverished state. The United Nations reports that aid workers have provided desperately needed food and other humanitarian aid to more than 338,000 South Sudanese facing famine in four key areas of Unity State. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN aid agencies have been scaling up relief operations in famine-stricken Unity State since February 20th, when the UN declared a localized famine in this region of South Sudan. The United Nations reports some of the 100,000 people facing starvation are dying, while another 1 million are on the brink of famine across war-torn South Sudan. Because of security concerns, the World Food Program has been airdropping food, emergency livelihood assistance, nutrition supplements, health and sanitation kits. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia tells VOA airdrops are the only option when truck convoys are unable to go by road to deliver aid. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Protesters supporting impeached South Korean President Park Geun-hye rallied in Seoul Saturday against the Constitutional Court's ruling that led to her removal from office. Police are bracing for more violence after two supporters of Park were killed as they tried to break through police lines outside the court Friday. A federal judge in the U.S. state of Wisconsin has blocked the enforcement of President Trump's revised travel ban that would prevent a Syrian woman and her child from entering the United States. Early this year, Mr. Trump's temporary travel ban barring admission to the U.S. to citizens of seven Muslim-majority countries was blocked by the federal courts. Trump's new ban goes into effect on March 16th. And faced with a shrinking pool of visas, the U.S. Embassy in Kabul has started turning away Afghan military translators and other Afghan nationals seeking to immigrate to the United States through a decade-old special visa program. For details on more news, we invite you to join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, reporting here in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
By and large, Nigerians have been quite delighted, and it's a day in which they've been giving glory to God.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari returns home following his medical vacation abroad.
He has nothing to offer the people. They are used to the Cameroon, where their money can corrupt and buy off everybody. But this time around, they have spent some billions of francs, and it's not changing the situation.
Cameroonian Prime Minister Philemon Yang says the country will remain united amidst calls for independence of English-speaking parts of the nation.
The benefit of domestic trade is it will allow now a partial supply of rhino horn from existing stockpiles. In other words, no injury to existing live animals whatsoever.
And the South African Parliament considers a measure to allow for limited trade and export of rhino horn for personal purposes. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has returned home after 51 days abroad, where he sought medical attention for a publicly undisclosed ailment. In a speech to Nigerians on his return, President Buhari also said he needs his rest this weekend, adding that he will be going for another round of medical review in a few weeks' time. But critics of the president have called on him to officially hand over power to Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, who has been acting while Buhari was away in London. For more regarding President Buhari's return, I reach Femi Adesina, a presidential spokesman.
There's been so much rejoicing, so much dancing in the streets, so much exchange of congratulations and goodwill messages and all that. I think by and large, Nigerians have been quite delighted. And it's a day in which they've been giving glory to God.
What does he plan to do this weekend since he arrived Friday? Saturday, Sunday, what does he plan doing?
You know, he said jocularly to the vice president that he deliberately came on a Friday so that people rest over the weekend while the vice president, the acting president, continues to act. So this weekend he's resting, and by Monday, a letter will be communicated to the National Assembly that he is back and that he will resume.
So after he sends the letter of intent, does that mean that he immediately returns to duty as the president of Nigeria and the vice president reverts to his position as the vice president?
Exactly that.
Has he been given all the clear by his doctors in the UK where he went on a medical vacation?
For him to have come home, we believe that, yes, they must have certified him okay enough to come. But don't forget, in his speech to the country, he also said that in some weeks he will be going back for a review.
Well, some people are saying that he spoke for 9 minutes and now people will pay closer attention to everything he says or every move he makes. Is ASO Rock ready for such scrutiny?
Anybody who takes public position must be ready for scrutiny. So nobody is intimidated by that.
So what do you say to Nigerian critics and those who said he should hand over power because he is too sick for the office?
They have a right to their opinion.
So going forward, what should we expect from the president before he returns for medical review again? What are the expectations? What should Nigerians expect from President Buhari?
He said it in his speech that he's now going to rededicate himself to serving Nigeria. So if he had served Nigeria well in the past, he's going to serve Nigeria a lot better. That's what he said.
As his spokesman, what is your message to Nigerians looking forward before he takes another vacation for review?
My message is that God has spared the president, brought him back to us. This president is determined to serve the country and bring enduring change. Let us all team up cooperate with him, give him our good wishes, continue to pray for him, and he will take the country to that place he desires to see Nigeria in, and which we all desire to see as Nigeria.
Are you emphatically denying speculation that his change mantra will not be affected despite the medical challenges?
No. Even while he was away, everything was going on seamlessly. There is a team. And a lot has been said of the vice president, who was the acting president, that he acquitted himself very well. So now that the president is back, that shows that we have two outstanding members of a team. And they can only do outstanding.
The president said he has never been sick like that. What does that mean?
Yeah, what it means is just that he had never been that sick. That's just what it means.
Femi Adesina is a spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, the Nigerian Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, has announced that presidential and parliamentary elections will be held in February 2019. This is the first time that INEC has come out early to set a timetable for a general election in Nigeria. The announcement comes at a time when there is growing concern and debate about the health condition of President Muhammadu Buhari. INEC officials say the move would enable the electoral body, as well as political parties and other stakeholders, to adequately prepare for the elections. To learn more, I reached Deputy Director of Public Affairs for INEC, Nick Dazang, in the northern Nigerian city of Kaduna.
The commission, after its meeting, decided to fix the conduct of the presidential election for 2019 on Saturday, 16th, and also for the governorship elections on 2nd March. Now, after several deliberations arising from a retreat it had in January and other meetings that it held in Abuja, the commission felt the time had come for us, like other developed countries such as the United States, for us to fix the dates for our elections so that at the end of presidential or governorship tenure, the date for an election is well known. For example, in the United States, at the end of a presidential tenure, the election takes place on 8th of every November of the end of that election year. So it is known by the media, by other stakeholders like the political parties and so on. And therefore, the political parties begin to prepare, and the commission itself begins to prepare in earnest for the conduct of the elections.
After you communicated this to political parties and to Nigerians as a whole about your initiative, how are political parties reacting to such move?
Well, I think the reaction is mixed so far, but we are also going to have another major meeting with the political parties on Tuesday next week. But what occurred to us when we had a retreat in January in Lagos was that if you remove all holidays, we, as at even January this year, we had less than 500 days between that time and 2019 to conduct the elections. And so the commission felt that there was the urgent need for the commission to be in an election mode and also to prepare other stakeholders, such as the political parties, the media, civil society and the security agencies, to begin to prepare in earnest.
What necessitated this action in the first place? And is this new move a permanent feature in the possible future in organizing elections in Nigeria?
Yes, we want to institute a permanent feature where the dates for elections are known by all and sundry. And also, once these dates are known, then the election management body and other stakeholders involved in the conduct of elections can begin to prepare in terms of educating members of the public, in terms of getting the necessary materials for the election, in terms of building the capacity of the staff permanent and that will conduct the elections, in terms of also building the capacity of the security agencies that would secure the environment for the elections, and in terms of also building the capacity of observers who would observe the election. So we think that going forward, making the or instituting these dates is going to be a win-win for the election management body and all stakeholders involved in elections.
Nick, some are speculating that INEC found it necessary to come up with such a move at this time due to reports of the president's ailment, and that it appears that INEC wants to lay down this gauntlet so the ruling party would have an advantage if the president, for some reason, is incapable of running for re-election. What is your reaction to that?
I can assure you that the fixing of this date has nothing to do with what is happening to the president. The commission operates independently of both the executive and the legislative branches, and it has always attempted to assert its independence by taking measures such as the fixing of this date, which show clearly that the commission has its own mind, that its own mind is not made for it elsewhere, and that it is not a puppet or a marionette of any other branch.
What else will Nigerians know in the coming days about these plans of yours to make Nigeria's election a permanent feature, so every Tom, Dick and Harry, as you say, will know when elections will be held across Nigeria?
Yes, going forward, we'll continue to educate Nigerians about this until it is etched in their consciousness. Just as what happens in the U.S., every American knows that at the end of the presidential tenure, elections take place on the 8th of November. Even I, a Nigerian, I know that. And in Ghana, they have also instituted 7th of December as the date for their general election. And that has also etched into the consciousness of Ghanaians. So that is the kind of thing we are trying to do in Nigeria going forward, so that we show also that our democracy is coming of age, and it's no more nascent. We have made some strides, and there's a need for us to appreciate these strides and to take advantage of these strides.
Nick Dazang is the Deputy Director of Public Affairs for the Nigerian Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC. He spoke with me from Kaduna. Cameroonian Prime Minister Philemon Yungji Yang has called on parents in the English-speaking parts of the country to allow their children to return to school. His remark came after he concluded a week-long tour of the seven divisions that make up the northwestern region Saturday. Mr. Yang reiterated the government's stance that examinations for the General Certificate of Education, or GCE, would proceed as originally scheduled. This, he says, despite teachers and lawyers' union strike, which forced the closure of schools in the English-speaking areas. For reaction to the Prime Minister's pronouncement, I reached the leader of the Cameroon Teachers Trade Union, Wilfred Tasang, at an undisclosed location in neighboring Nigeria.
It is not the first time the Prime Minister is doing that. I hope that at the end of his tour, he will have the courage to tell his masters in Yaoundé that ambitious parents are bent to have lasting solutions to age-old problems that they have been facing concerning the education of their children, the injustice perpetrated on us by the government of La République of Cameroon. He should have given himself the courage. He's been asking parents to have to take the courage and send their children to school, and the parents have told him to his face that they will not until they have all the solutions. We hope that he himself now will have the courage to tell the government what he has seen on the field.
Are you therefore saying that the tour of the Prime Minister is a mere public relation exercise for the government in Yaoundé against the agitations in the English-speaking areas?
I think it is an expression of government desperation, because he is not bringing solutions to the issue that the teachers raised. He is not bringing solutions to the issues raised by lawyers. He is not bringing solutions to the issues raised by the business community. He has nothing to offer the people. They are used to the Cameroon, where their money can corrupt and buy off everybody. But this time around, they have spent so billions of years in France, and it's not changing the situation.
He says exams will go on as originally scheduled, May 15 for the practical exams, June 1st for the rest of the exams. Whether students in the English-speaking Cameroonian areas register to participate in the GE exams or not, wouldn't this have a detrimental effect on the students there in those areas that you teach?
We can trust this government that they will go ahead and give examinations to the children, whether children have prepared for the examinations or not, whether they have registered for the examinations or not. These are intimidatory tactics. You cannot give examinations to children who have not prepared for the exam. you cannot examine children certificate exams where they have not registered. So the government cannot do that. Where they insist on doing that to Francophone children, we have no problem, but it would be telling the international community that this government does not care about Anglophone children. And that is what we have been trying to tell the whole world.
Concerns raised by some English-speaking Cameroonian activists is that they are being marginalized and that they are being Francophonized. Others have demanded independence. Some are saying for Ambazonia and all that. The Prime Minister was categorical in stating that it will not happen and that the Constitution of Cameroon will be respected irrespective of these agitations, and that these people calling for the independence of Ambazonia or the likes are just dreamers, and this will not happen. Your take?
The Prime Minister would not want this to happen so that he can continue to occupy his position as the chief privileged Anglophone slave in this country. But we will disappoint him because God himself has decided that this will happen. During his lifetime and in 2017, it will happen.
What is the best way forward to resolve this impasse and to return English-speaking Cameroon to the fore so business will run as usual, so Cameroon will remain as a united country and that your demands are met?
This country can never be united. This country can never be united anymore. United in this country means that Anglophone become Francophone. And we have two cultures in this country that cannot cohabit together. We have tried to make it work, and we have failed. Not because we didn't want to be with Francophone, but because the government in Yaoundé has a very dark purpose concerning us. And that purpose is assimilation and total annihilation. We are living in a country where Anglophone children must be taught by Francophone teachers, taught in French, taught in Pidgin, taught in Creole. Our children have been destroyed. We can't continue to live in harmony with the people who don't appreciate us. At the time that we came into a union with the Republic, it was a federal system of government, and it was indicated in the 1961 Constitution that the Federation would never be tampered with. But the French government, the Francophone government, and the Republic went ahead and tampered on that Federation, and the only purpose was that they should lay their hands on our natural resources, on our education, on our legal system, and destroy it. This is what they have done, and we have had enough of it. We cannot take it anymore. So we want to pray to the international community. The United Nations would become irrelevant in the world if it does not step in now in Cameroon and sort out these issues that the UN itself created in 1961 by not making sure that Southern Cameroon has its independence, and or by not making sure that we entered into a proper deal of unification in 1961.
Wilfred Tassang is the leader of the Cameroon Teachers Trade Union. He spoke with me from an undisclosed location in Nigeria. The Kenyan healthcare crisis continues as nurses in public health facilities are now demanding to be paid $200 risk allowance monthly after the government awarded striking doctors a similar amount. They also want the payment of the allowance backdated to July 1st, 2016, as is the case with doctors. The Kenyan National Union of Nurses General Secretary argues that nurses face 30 times more risk than doctors in their line of duty and deserve that payment. David Ohito is the outgoing digital editor at the Standard Media Group. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the Nyanza regional city of Kisumu to find out about the nurses' demands.
We are not trying to find lasting solutions to the problem. You know, all these guys work in the same place. If you are going into the theater, same doctor has same risk exposure like the nurse who is handling the same patient. And in any case, the nurse stays longer with the patient. So even the risk for the nurses should be up high and above what the doctors are getting. I think we're in a crisis which you can only equate to a failed state. Where a government cannot reach any consensus, cannot keep its own word, cannot find solutions to basic problems, whose bureaucrats cannot have meaningful discussions with professionals. So, again, we are again thrown in the mud here, and we don't know how long it will take. And now, with just a few months to the election, the situation is getting worse and it's taking a more of a political dimension than a real industrial settlement of a problem.
There are people who suggest that the government has failed to finalize the collective bargaining agreement where they could have taken care of all these issues. Do you feel that the government maybe has mishandled this?
The government got it wrong from day one. It's being mishandled by the bureaucrats, the people in the ministry, while health is a devolved function which was assigned to counties. There's been no commensurate allocation of resources to support such functions. In a so-called an agricultural country like Kenya, once you devolve health, agriculture, and basic education, why would you retain all about 65% of the resources of the national government? To do what? This is why we are saying the approach is wrong, and we need a lot of goodwill from those at the presidency and that kind of cadre of level of leadership. I really understand that the basics of giving good health to Kenyans in every corner should be a priority, and we need to get doctors back to work sooner rather than later.
Doctors aside, of course, we appreciate the good work the health community, the doctors and the nurses perform. But once government acquiesces to the demands of the doctors and the nurses, do you see this escalating to other workers? We had teachers, for instance, won a strike some time back. Do you think other civil servants may demand better remuneration?
Yes, there's right now public universities which have been closed down because the lecturers are demanding better remuneration. And these are part of the challenges we're just trying to confront as a country. The challenge is that we are getting into the political mode because the election is just about 3 months away on August 8th, and people are getting jittery and trying to concentrate more on the politics rather than solving the critical problems that are facing the country.
Do you think the current government in the remaining few months will be able to sort these issues out?
This government has been baptized by another name, failure, corruption, name it. I don't think what they did do in 4 years, they can do in 3 months. And looking at the sample of the leadership, they have never provided a solution that somebody can look up to. I can assure you, no better solution in sight soon.
David Ohito is the outgoing judicial editor at the Standard newspaper. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kisumu. The South African Parliament could soon consider a new law to allow for limited trade and export of rhino horn for personal purposes. The government proposed the draft legislation earlier this year, and until an initial 30-day period for public comment wraps. For VOA, Thuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg that while the bill has support, it has angered animal rights groups.
In the proposed law, the government seeks to allow domestic trade in rhino horn as well as individual exports of 2 rhino horns at a time, only for personal use and under strict control. South Africa's Department of Environmental Affairs proposes that any sale will include the full details of the buyer and seller, a permit, and the genetic profile information of each horn sold. Domestic trade in rhino horn was banned in South Africa in 2009. In 2015, 2 independent rhino breeders won a court case challenging the domestic ban. The government tried to overturn that ruling on appeal but failed. The Department of Environmental Affairs proposed this new legislation to comply with the court's 2015 verdict. The draft law has excited independent rhino breeders who have fought hard to get the ban lifted. Pelham Jones is the chairman of the Private Rhino Owners Association.
The benefit of domestic trade is it will allow now a partial supply of rhino horn from existing stockpiles, in other words, no injury to existing live animals whatsoever, to be traded in South Africa, to be exported with a CITES permit.
But opponents say there should be no exceptions when it comes to trade in rhino horn. Animal rights groups believe even limited legalization will open a loophole for criminal syndicates. Joe Shaw is the manager of the World Wildlife Fund's South Africa's Rhino program.
We don't believe that the necessary control mechanisms are currently in place at an international, national, or provincial level to enable law enforcement and permitting staff to be able to regulate this legal domestic trade alongside the existing levels of illegal trade in horn.
International trade in rhino horn has been banned since 1977. Jones of the Rhino Owners Association says there is currently no proof that the international ban has protected the rhino. He argues that some legal trade will help fund conservation efforts.
Due to this severe security cost, many reserves have in fact given up and have sold all of their rhino populations. So this revenue will at least help to mitigate certain of our operational expenses.
A rhino horn can sell for up to $23,000 every year. According to government statistics, South Africa loses about 1,000 rhinos to poachers eager to traffic the horns to Asian countries, where they are believed to be able to treat various ailments despite lack of scientific backing. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
If we remember, baby, oh na na na, baby, oh na na na, baby, oh na na na, oh na na na, baby, oh na na, baby, oh na na na, baby, oh na na na, oh na 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 na. Waza moti moti moti, sikia. Waza na shitwa kijoti, na umi ah. Moyo wangu ti 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 unakimbia.
Dana. Hey, hey, this one a party time, cause there's no stress. Yeah, this one a party time, cause life is too short. Yeah, have to feel alright, cause this is in my life. Yeah,
party mood, hey no party mood, yeah. Party mood, the mo party mood, yeah.
Be happy.
Hello, hello,
hello. I say be happy.
If you're happy and you know, show your hands, show your hands. If you're happy and you know, show your hands, show your hands.
Hey. Everybody in the air, send your gun, pull up and go with
yeah, my shiny border.
You know God is good, friends are good. I'm stressless.
Be happy. Hello, hello, hello. Zendi happy. Oh, be happy. Hello, hello, hello.
Zendi happy.
Oh, be happy.
Baby, listening. Now, we know a baby matter. Daily and weekly and monthly and quarter. Now, we don't talk to butter. Family to smile and we know the quanta. That would just say Yoruba. Make them no go forget the Badona Baba.
From the continent, we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Xiao Gang Chang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the quarrel based on envy does not end on time. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government, through the Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced its continuing support to the education sector in Bauchi, Nigeria. This five-year Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, sets out the shared and individual commitments for collaboration in the education sector made by both USAID and the government of Bauchi, and provides a framework for mutual accountability for education activities in Bauchi State. The MOU supports the Bauchi State government's education goals and establishes a preliminary plan for joint monitoring and evaluation of progress. USAID supports Nigeria's efforts to improve the quality of and access to basic education. Currently, USAID implements three activities that support Bauchi State efforts to improve the education sector: Northern Education Initiative Plus, Education Crisis Response, and the Leadership, Empowerment, Advocacy, and Development. These activities build state and local government capacity and systems that will teach approximately 2 million primary school children how to read and allow nearly 551,000 children the opportunity to attend classes in community-based learning centers by the year 2020. The United States commends Bauchi State for its extraordinary efforts to provide greater learning opportunities for its children, said USAID Mission Director Michael Harvey. This MOU will expand the partnership between USAID and Bauchi State to improve primary education in Bauchi. The United States is proud to work with its partner Nigeria to provide a better future for the children of Nigeria.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.